Hi, and welcome to Film Forums. I'm Richard Williams, creator of this platform, a place dedicated to the filmmaking community. We interview members of the film industry to find out what it really takes to make a movie, bring a script to screen, or secure that acting role. If that sounds good to you, please subscribe to us on YouTube and follow us on your favourite podcasting platform.
Hi there, welcome to Film Forums. My name is Aisha Shbeli and I have a special guest with me today. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, I'm Liam O'Donnell, the writer-director of Skylines.
Can you tell us a little bit more about your action-packed sci-fi?
Yes, it is part three in a very unlikely franchise of films that are Alien Invasion Saga that started in 2010, Skyline. Part two was Beyond Skyline, which came out in 2017 and is on Netflix right now. And we were really, really lucky to get a third one made, which will be coming out December 18th.
What was your inspiration for this trilogy?
It's always been, you know, what's right in front of me, like as we go. You know, the first movie was the co-director, producer had just bought this penthouse apartment overlooking Los Angeles. And we looked up there and said, like, got to film a movie in here somehow. And it was all kind of based on the practical locations of what we could do within the apartment to then what else was in that building, which was, you know, a parking garage, parking gate, stairwells, a pool deck, and of course a helipad. So it was very much kind of like organically from there, like how do I create a narrative around that? And how do we create a really cool alien menace that we hadn't quite seen before? And so that the whole like idea of the siren light, it was all sort of a little bit of a riff on Close Encounters with the beautiful alien lights, but these ones were, you know, like a siren kind of calling you to your doom. And so, yeah, that was going to be like a one and done chapter to us. We didn't quite have a sequel idea, but in post the studio was happy with the movie and they started asking us about it. So we all kind of sat down and hatched a treatment for what we thought part two could be. It ended up being kind of similar to that, but it just took a really long time to get there. And then with part two, I kind of ended it like, they walked off into the sunset, they beat the aliens, it was over. And we did a test screening of an early cut of that. And everyone said like, what, that's it? So we kind of went from the first movie that ended on a really big cliffhanger and that pissed people off. And then I made a movie that had like a ton of closure and that pissed people off. So it was like Goldilocks. It's like, okay, I have to find the right balance. And came up with these bookends with the Rose character who was played by Lindsay Morgan. And that seemed to, you know, kind of be a nice balance. And it also allowed me to do like one more genre mash in Beyond Skyline because I was having so much fun doing so many different things. Now I was like, I'm getting to do a full-on sci-fi like Star Wars type scene to end the movie. So I just felt like if I never got to direct another movie again, I did like everything that I wanted to do in that one movie. And that ended up sort of inspiring what could be possible for a third one to do a completely different genre again and do a big space adventure.
I have to say, I really enjoyed Skylines, the newest one. I haven't seen the predecessors, but
that's
I really
great.
Enjoyed it.
I'm happy that you didn't. I think it's like, I'm glad, I hope it works for people that haven't seen the others, you know?
Yeah, oh yeah, I think it's definitely a standalone. I didn't even realize that there were, you know, the previous ones until I went away and did some research. Like, so I think that that's good. If you watch the previous ones, then you're continuing the story and you're familiar with the background. But, you know, if you're watching it for the first time, you don't feel like, you know, like you've suddenly been thrown into a sequel and you don't understand what's going on. So that I think is very positive.
Oh, thank you.
And you mentioned your treatment, you know, coming up with the treatment and things like that. What would be your best piece of advice for someone who's trying to write a treatment for a studio?
I'm doing it right now for one, and it's different each movie. You know, like sometimes it comes really quick and it's like the actual shape of the movie feels like you have it immediately. And sometimes, like as of right now, I kind of have half of a treatment and I'm feeling like I actually went into a script and started vomit drafting like the first act, because I felt like that was going to give me a better understanding on what the full treatment would be. So it's always a little different. I find like, you know, narrative models are always very helpful and references are always very helpful. And I think like with the second movie, there was no narrative model. And I think that's why it's such a unique kind of freewheeling weird movie. It wasn't like I was like, well, this is like a Night of the Living Dead movie, like the first one was. Like, this is Night of the Living Dead. It's like inciting incident, then everyone's stuck here, and then there's distrust, and it's all going to kind of end up in a very dour, dark ending. And then I think this third movie was very much like it was a classic space adventure movie. So like narratively, the first act, there's a couple of beats that you know you're going to have to hit, where they're going to have to explain the mission, you're going to have to put the team together, you're going to have the refusal of the call, but you know, we're going to set sail on this adventure by the end of the first act. So sometimes those are really helpful as the jumping off point, and then you kind of have to obviously get into the weeds and make it more unique. But yeah, to me, it's like the best movies and the hooks are the ones to me that do kind of sort of come within a quick flash, and you can kind of feel that shape and build everything around it. And I think it definitely is different from time to time. But what I like about working in this independent space and doing something like Skylines, whereas maybe the studio version of the movie, is that there's a lot of the questions that they try to ask in the studio thing that I don't know if they're relevant, where they keep going like, why does this movie have to happen right now? Why does it have to come out right now? And I don't think that's actually a relevant question, but it sounds smart when you say it in a meeting. But like, there's no reason why any movie has to exist. There's no reason why any movie has to come out right now. It's like, why is it important to you? What inspires you? Why not try to make that movie? So sometimes I feel like they can kind of like overthink some of those things and make themselves feel smart in the room, but it's not necessarily the most important thing to a moviegoer when they're seeing the movie. And if you just are open and embrace things as a filmmaker, then it is going to feel relevant to the moment. I feel like, strangely enough, Skylines is like super relevant, but it wasn't like I was trying to make a pandemic movie. It was just what was inspiring me at the time. So some of those things can just be accident. So yeah, not to rail on about that, but I do think it's kind of like, you can overthink things. And sometimes it is just about like, just tell the best story that you can.
Also, I think the time that it takes to make a movie, you know, like by the time you go through post-production, it can be like a year before your film comes out. So where you thought your film may have been relevant, even in the landscape that you were writing it in, may have completely changed.
Totally.
2020, I think,
totally
quite
changed.
A good example of that.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there was even more. I mean, there's not to get too into that, but like in Skylines, there's obviously some commentary on xenophobia, you know, anti-immigrant, anti-other sentiment. And that's obviously influenced by the world that we're living in and everything that's happened the past 4 years. But I remember I had some lines that were like more overtly referencing, you know, building walls versus building bridges. And it was like, I remember even on set being like, I don't think anyone's going to want to hear that, like, you know, in 2020, you know? So I was like, kind of knowing that I think I would have dated myself too much if I tried to be too overt in some of the references.
Also, the action side of it was just like, for me, I'm a total action fan, so I will take action in any format. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got people involved, you know, for the stunt side of things? Because again, that's something that we don't hear enough about sometimes.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm a huge action fan too. And it all kind of can come down to like, to hiring just the right people. And I feel like the lessons that I learned in part two, you know, it was going to be like a war movie, but it wasn't going to be a martial arts movie. And when we went over to Indonesia, you know, someone suggested Iko and Yayan, a producer, that we had dinner. And I was like, oh my God, the Raid guys, like they could be in this movie. That's insane. And that immediately just had to happen. So I did everything I could to get them in the movie. And luckily that worked out. And they, you know, added this insane level of choreo with like men in suits playing aliens, which is the most fun part, I think, about Beyond Skyline. So I knew I wanted to do more of that in part three. But I also wanted to do a different type of creature because we're going to have the big guys in their suits, but they're big, pretty big and lumbering, and they can I kind of know what they can do now. They're limited to any time they're moving at a certain speed, they have to be CG. So I wanted to have a new type of alien that could move really, really fast and be a little bit more nimble and easier to shoot. So we had these shadow type creatures that were all these stuntmen in leotards that were these really, really talented parkour and martial artists. And they all kind of came from Real Deal Stunts out of Berlin. So that's Real Deal Stunts is really cool because it's like three younger filmmakers, and one of them is Cha Lee, who plays the Z character. He's part of the group. The other guy is
amazing.
Yeah. The other one is Fong, who played the matriarch. So they are big baddie in this one. You know, when her face opens, that was all Fong's face, who's actually acting her out. I was saying her lines on set and he would be moving his face to it. So it was kind of this really fun collaboration for me, because anytime the director gets to like speak, like say lines on set and act out, you're like nerding out on yourself. And then Jean is the other guy, and he was doing our second unit action unit stuff. So we would do like a lot of the action scenes. We would film everything with Lindsay and a lot of the cast on the main unit, and we would get all the masters on this side. And then the second unit would come and like get her overs onto the aliens. And that was the only way we could make the schedule work. So even if her stunt double in the movie is kind of used more for scheduling, because she can do a lot of the stunts herself, like her big wire work thing where she kills the two aliens at once, that was all her in camera, because there was not going to be any second unit in that hallway. But a lot of it was all just kind of schedule based, that we were like, main unit is all this direction, second unit's all this direction. And that was like a huge headache for like the first scene that we filmed, which was her running through the warehouse, because I'd never worked with a second unit before. And I was like, okay, we're going to get better at this. And we did. We ended up kind of like trading it off and figuring out what was best to do on each unit. When you're filming big creatures like that, they have a tendency to like fall over and fall apart, and they're very time consuming. So a lot of that, went to the second unit, and I could pop off in between stuff or go during the weekend when they were filming and have a little bit of fun on both units. You just can't get away with like doing action on an indie budget unless you hire a really awesome team and you have actors that are like willing to go kind of crazy with very limited prep time.
I can see that. I mean, I think that everyone did a fantastic job. The action was very believable and really, really well executed. As I say, I was absolutely glued to the screen when Z was fighting
Owens. Yeah. Owens.
Oh, what a scene. Honestly, amazing. Yeah.
That was a lot of fun to like build the tension in that scene. And then from my point of view, I'm like, you know, Daniel Bernhardt's like a black belt who's been doing action movies for like 30 years. And then Cha is like probably the fastest person I've ever seen. And then Jean was handling the camera. So I was like, we shot the kind of graphic novel like coverage where they're like the tension. And then he does the axe kick. And then I was like, all right, I'll check in with you guys at lunch. Like it was like all done. They're just so fast and they kind of like just kick the crap out of each other for a whole day.
Amazing. The next thing that I wanted to ask you about was, you know, again, because you mentioned that you had two films previous to this, am I right in assuming that you were able to build on garnering your budget for each film, or was it roughly the same all the way through? How did you go about financing the three films?
It's roughly the same budget for all three films. It's within this like, you know, 10 to 13 range. I think the second one maybe 14. But the first one like could have been finished cheaper. It could have been much cheaper. We shot it for under $1 million, and then it got bought by Relativity Universal. So it was like, it within post, we spent more money on the sound and the VFX than I think we would have if it had just been an indie that we needed, you know, finish ourselves. So that one ended up, I think of all the post budgets, that one's probably the highest and had the tiny, really, really small production budget. So it was kind of like looking at part two and be like, well, we have a bunch of assets that have already been built. You know, we have these spaceships. We have these, you know, these alien creatures. We have a lot of the sound effects that, you know, we're indie filmmakers. So we're going to reuse whatever really works and is really good. So part two was more like, okay, let's look at that budget pie. I want to use a lot more on the production side. You know, I'd rather have the visual effects maybe not be at the same super high level on every shot and still have a good look and a consistent level, but I'd rather have a more kind of action-packed movie than kind of have such a kind of low shooting budget and then have a huge post budget. That was an imbalance that I wanted to correct on part two. And then the issues with part two were that I really wanted to build like one amazing set and keep redressing it, which was kind of put into the script because the first act takes place in a subway tunnel. The second act took place in a spaceship, and the third act took place in underground bunkers in Southeast Asia. So my concept was we're going to build this amazing subway set, and then we're going to redress it to be an alien ship, and then we're going to redress it to be a bunker. It ended up not working out that way. I don't think maybe I didn't have the vision at the time to really prove that that could work, but it could have. And I still kind of believe that that was the smartest way to have done it. We ended up lucking out in some different ways because we got to shoot in an actual subway station in Toronto and on subway tracks in Toronto. And the place where we ended up filming in Indonesia had like a bunker set that was already standing from another project that we redressed and reused. So it didn't quite work in practice in that, but the philosophy was still something that I used for part three. Which was like to make one big canyon set and completely redress it and reuse it a bunch of times for the planet. And even to the point where then once we had used it so many times, I started looking at our spaceship set and I was like, we could use the spaceship for some more alien planet. And we ended up putting a bunch of liquid latex and alien cobwebs on top of the existing spaceship set and using that, for just more environments for us to use within that. That's a Cobalt One environment. So for me, it's like, it has to kind of start with the writing. The first movie I ever worked on was AVP2 as a consultant, and they built a big sewer set, and it was a really amazing set. And they spent all this time and all this money on it, and it was really, really awesome. And then that was it. It was just didn't come back to it again. And so that kind of stuck in my head is like, if you build a set that awesome, shouldn't you like, you know, just keep redressing it and keep using it, especially if you're on this indie budget. And so, yeah, it kind of has to go in with like, okay, this is going to be a corridors movie, because if you break down most alien movies, no matter where the environment is, whether it's on Earth like AVP2 was, guess what? You have to find corridors because that's where they work. So we had to put them into sewers and we had to put them into hallways. So that was why I was like, well, if a subway tunnel is a corridor, a spaceship's a corridor, a bunker is a corridor. So it kind of like using environments and trying to break them down to like what their essentials are and how they work cinematically and how you can use them efficiently to make something that looks a lot bigger than it costs.
Thank you so much. And definitely stay in touch.
You too. Take care.